This seems like a really simple way to evade detection. You put in a random time in between keystrokes. This should have been done 10 years ago, right? But on the other hand, why is the detection software looking at speed of key inputs as a metric to determine human versus not human?
All that and more on Security Intelligence. Hello and welcome to Security Intelligence, IBM's weekly cybersecurity podcast where we break down the most interesting stories in the field with the help of our panel of experts. I'm your host, Matt Kaczynski, and joining me today, Chris Thomas, aka Space Rogue, X-Force Global Lead of Technical Eminence and part of the Not the Situation Room podcast, and Sridhar Mapidi, IBM Fellow, CTO, IBM Security. Thanks for being here with me, folks. Today, we are talking about the AI governance gap, malware that acts like a person, how social engineers are manipulating stock prices and ballooning bug bounties. But first, let's talk about malicious AI agents. Now, there's been a lot of talk about how attackers could weaponize AI agents, and we're finally starting to see it happen for real, or at least in proofs of concept. And two in particular came out last week that I'd like to talk about. The first is from researchers at Datadog, who identified a technique they call CoFish because it takes advantage of Microsoft Copilot Studio. Attackers can basically use it to build malicious AI agents that secretly steal OAuth tokens in the background. The second was from researchers at Palo Alto, who reported on what they call agent session smuggling. This uses the agent-to-agent communication protocol to secretly transmit malicious commands to a target agent. Basically, the protocol allows two agents to talk to each other, and the user doesn't necessarily see what they're saying. So if you've got a malicious one, it can secretly say some you know, nasty stuff that makes the other agent do some bad things. So I want to start by with you, actually, Chris. Is this a case of legitimate tools being put to illegitimate ends, or is it a deeper flaw? What do you think's going on?
I think it's a big part of that. I mean, the criminals are going to use whatever tools they have available, right? Because criminals are going to crime. And if they have AI tools available, they're going to use those AI tools. The advantage that the criminals have here is that they can just sort of experiment and play around with stuff and throw stuff at the wall and see what works. And some of it works, and I'm sure there's a whole bunch of stuff they've tried that hasn't worked that we haven't seen because it didn't work.
Makes sense. Sridhar, you have any thoughts to add on that?
We're going to see a number of such attacks in the future, right? If you rewind a little bit from Black Hat timeframe, right? We saw Gemini, which has got a very similar attack as this agent session smuggling. And we also saw Echo Leaks, which had a very similar kind of a look and feel like a co-phishing where it was a mechanism to go steal a token, right? So I think if I step back, I kind of look at agents being autonomous, and that creates problems of oversight. Agents can be coerced into doing something like, you know, social engineering of humans, social engineering of agents. And also agents are non-deterministic in nature. And attackers, you'll see, will take advantage of these principles more and more as we look forward in the next few years to come.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the social engineering angle because I thought of that too, right? And what's interesting is that both of these kind of illustrate social engineering, but in slightly different ways, right? The first is a little more classic, the CoFish anyway, because it preys on users' trust of Microsoft, right? You think, oh, an agent hosted on Microsoft, that's got to be perfectly legitimate, right? And of course, somebody could be using it for illegitimate ends. The other one that's really interesting, though, is that the agent-to-agent attack, the agent session smuggling, it's almost like socially engineering an AI agent, right? Like you're kind of tricking the good agent with your malicious agent. I was wondering if you folks had any thoughts about this new frontier when it comes to being able to now socially engineer some of our technology, maybe in a way that we couldn't in the past. And let's start with you, Sridhar, because you brought up the social engineering thread. You have any thoughts on that?
I think it's about making sure that we scope the agent, right? You know, I mean, agents cannot be doing everything. You have to put blinders. We talked about a good analogy of social engineering. So the question is, how do you put blinders on the agent such that it is only doing certain things for certain individuals, either on behalf of an individual or in behalf of an agent or autonomously, but being able to scope it, extremely fine-tune it to either time, either, you know, resource actions, either scope in terms of location, that will limit the agent from getting coerced into doing things that is not supposed to do through social, quote-unquote, social engineering.
Absolutely. Chris, what about you? Any thoughts there?
I haven't seen anything yet where one agent is specifically manipulating another agent, but I can totally see that that's where that where things are headed, right? Like I said, criminals are going to crime. They're going to use whatever tools they have. And if they have an agent as a tool that they can use, they will absolutely apply that against another agent to try to manipulate it, coerce it, get it to do things that maybe it's not supposed to do. So we have to have those blinders in place. We have to be able to create those agents so that they can't get out of their little sandbox. And no matter how much the attackers try to manipulate them, they still can't give up the information that the attacker wants.
I think I do want to pause you for a second, right? And before we leave this topic, I think this is the tip of the iceberg, right? If I look at the agent behavior, the attackers exploiting this autonomous behavior for additional threat privileges, because that is the easiest thing to attack, right? You know, Chris, what did you guys publish? 30% of the attacks that you're seeing it through valid credentials. So it is so easy to go and get these things, valid credentials, and launch an attack. But as you go beyond that, right, go one level beyond the tip of the iceberg to the next level, this is where you can see red teaming and blue teaming have to come together. This is where you see agents being, you know, non-deterministic, so they will drift, and attackers will take advantage of this drift. So this, to me, is a beginning of a new class of attacks that we will see. And you are seeing this only because it is so much easier to use valid credentials to attack versus trying to do something which is rocket science.
You know, yeah, I think that's a really good point. I'm glad you brought that up, because that ties into conversations we've had in the past, doesn't it, Sridhar, about how when the AI agents enter the equation, how you approach identity and access management kind of has to change a little bit, right? Yeah, and so I'm glad you brought that up, because this is one of those cases where you're taking that credential-based attack, which we've seen launched against human employees, and now you're launching it against a new kind of employee, a mechanical one, basically, right?
I mean, criminals and hackers alike are both very lazy people at the root core, right? We're lazy.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Anything we can do to make our job easier is what we do. And having valid credentials makes the job so much easier. So anything that can get the attacker the valid credentials is definitely where they're going to go first.
So do you think it's easier then to get valid credentials from an agent than it is from a human employee? Or is it just a, you know, similar level of challenge, but it's just a different way of going about it? How do we think about that?
I think we have to think about it. And if you use the current techniques, I think you're talking about how we have to fundamentally think about changing some of our, you know, behavior as well as how we do things, right? Today, we do a really good job of authenticating human beings. We do two-factor authentication, multi-factor authentication, all the cool things, right? But machines don't have that, right? So we tend to use functional IDs, which are basically giving them overprivilege. Instead, I think what we should be thinking about is to identify the agent with some level of identity, just like you would identify a human being, right? End of the day, agents are your next level of insiders. So just like you would identify a human being, you have to identify an agent. Once you identify, you have to do the same thing that we do with humans, authenticate them, right? And then you figure out how to scope what that agent can do, both the good and the bad. And while you're doing that, that's when you can think about a very, very fine level of granularity of observability, so that we can then monitor all the behaviors and be able to detect anomalous behavior very quickly.
Chris, I thought I saw you start to say something. Do you have anything to add there?
No, I'm just agreeing with basically everything that's being said here. We have to identify the agents, then authenticate them and give them the appropriate permissions that they need, just like we do with our human users, right? So even though the user is not specifically human, they still need to follow the same identity and authentication processes, or tailored for AI agents, not the same, obviously, but they need to be identified and authenticated properly.
So it sounds like the way we treat, you know, human identities and non-human identities is going to get closer and closer over time. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah. And the only thing is, you know, the scale is exponentially different than humans versus non-humans. So back to your point, right? You cannot use all existing tools. Existing processes may apply, but you're talking about a different magnitude of scale. So you need to think about automation. You need to think about being proactive. You need to think about a lot of things that are more dynamic in nature than static in nature.
So maybe that then is a good segue into the AI governance question, because we have this AI governance gap right now, right? And this is coming out of both research that IBM has conducted and an article from IBM's Judith Aquino, kind of breaking some of that research down for us. Now, organizations are deploying AI tools faster than they can develop robust risk and governance frameworks for those tools, according to IBM's AI at the Core 2025 research report. The kind of key figure here, at least as far as I'm concerned, is that 72% of businesses surveyed said they have integrated AI into at least one business function, but only 23.8% of businesses surveyed said they have extensive governance frameworks in place. So that's a pretty big gap between who's deployed and who's got extensive governance in place. And so I want to throw back to you again here, Sridhar, you know, because again, this touches on things we just talked about and conversations we've had before this about the gap between what we when we deploy AI and the governance that needs to catch up. Why does such a gap exist? Why does governance lag behind deployment pretty much every time we introduce something new?
I think we've seen this movie so many times, right? We've seen this movie so many times. Most recent movie has been the cloud playbook. You know, deploy fast, govern later, get breach in between, right? As simple as that. It's the same rinse and repeat story we've seen like, you know, a few times, right? And the reason that that happens is because of the innovation. End of the day, businesses have to innovate. They have to go and make themselves relevant, right? You know, we all move to cloud for the operational benefits, efficiencies, et cetera. AI is going to help us with productivity, not just with the employees, but also consumers, ease of use, et cetera. And they have to leverage that. As a result, you've got innovation, which is primarily driven by the applications team accelerating. And then meanwhile, you've got, you know, the risks trying to catch up. And if you don't balance it really well, that's why you keep seeing the gap keep widening up, widening.
Absolutely. Chris, I'm wondering if you have thoughts on the kind of cybersecurity implications of these gaps when they pop up. Kind of like Sridhar said, it's like deploy, get hacked in between, and then finally get to some governance. What do you think about that?
This is a similar playbook. Like we're repeating the same story that we've repeated with, you know, bring your own device, cloud, work from home. Now we have AI, and we implement the technology first. And then we like, oh, wait, we got to put some rules around this and figure out exactly how we're supposed to do this. And a lot of times we look at, okay, just make it work and then we'll figure it out later. And that it's that gap in between that the attacker looks for because they see that gap. They see an opportunity for them to leverage that lack of governance so that they can get into your organization and do what it is that they do. And this is a common problem that we've had with new technologies, and AI isn't any different here. It's important to recognize that and realize that your AI is now a risk, and you need to, if you don't have the governance in place, then try to mitigate that risk as much as you can by network design, authentication, et cetera, other tools that you have until your governance can catch up.
No, that's it. You cannot ban AI. You cannot ban devices, right? You cannot ban it. You cannot ban from employees working from home, right? Employees will be employees and they'll use it anyway. So we have to Chris's point, I think we have to, the choice is to make it secure enablement or like have a blind exposure, right? That's the choices that you have. One of the things that I talk about is security is becoming more and more distributed. Right? And it's become more and more shared responsibility, right? It's not the question of, okay, the security persona owns security and the application teams don't own security and hence, you know, let me go run with it and come back and catch it. But instead, be able to have a mechanism by which we can start thinking about finally learning from all of these movies that we've seen into making it a shared responsibility, right? I kind of call it like a guardrails versus checkpoints or gates. When you have a guardrail, fine, you can define a policy which says, sure, on this speedway, you can go at 55 miles, even if it's a 50-mile speed limit. That's okay, right? As long as you don't jump the guardrails. But the other hand, if you put a lot of checkpoints, you know what happens at checkpoints, right? Like at toll gates, there's a long traffic jam. So that's a cultural change that we have to think about it. We have tools for sure, But that's the cultural gap that I'm hoping that at some point we will learn.
A lot of times people look at security, even as practitioners, who are there the no people. Oh, you can't do that. It's bad. It's not secure. You can't do it. And I've always tried to look at it like, no, that's security's job is to say yes and figure out how to do it securely. And to Sidhar's point, it is a cultural change that we have to look at here, and that it's everybody's responsibility to think of these security. How can I do this and be secure at the same time? Not just how do I do it and rush it out the door. So it is everybody's responsibility, but it should be also everybody's job to figure out, yes, we can do this and we can do it securely, not just no, because it's not secure.
Yeah, I'm glad you both brought that up because, you know, that was kind of what I was going to ask is that, like, you know, is it, I don't know, maybe the word I was looking for is responsible, right? Is it responsible to deploy this technology before you have governance? And it seems like that's completely the wrong question to ask because realistically, like you said, Sridhar and you, Chris, you can't ban this stuff. People are going to use it. So you can either kind of stand there and try to stop them from doing something they're going to do, or you can enable them to do it in a secure way, right? You got to be realistic about this stuff. And so that leads me to another question, and it's kind of a big one. And, you know, I'm sorry to spring it on you, but one of the things I often hear from people when I talk to them about, you know, sort of enabling everybody to be more secure in an enterprise context is how you can give all this kind of security training and half of it just doesn't stick with people, right? They just don't follow it. So do you have any thoughts on what this culture change looks like to make this kind of distributed shared responsibility model actually work? Any thoughts there?
I think part of it is understanding the risk of to the business, right? I mean, that risk is a, you know, fine, it is probably a gray word, but at the same point, if it makes it relevant to the application teams, right? This is my sensitive data, or I'm holding the sensitive data of my clients that I'm serving. How do you understand that in a manner that shows that they're taking a risk by not looking at certain security, you know, vulnerabilities, for example, right? I think if you understand that cleanly, then, you know, it's very similar to saying that, sure, I don't want to buy insurance right now. But if you show the likelihood of insurance, a likelihood of a storm or a flood next to an ocean versus a likelihood on a mountain, right? It may change. It may change the thinking to say, I may want to get flood insurance, right? So that awareness is number one. And number two, I feel, is gamification, right? Bit of a gamification will help in terms of, like, how do we security, you know, including myself, right? I will poke holes at myself first. We tend to make it very complex, right? We tend to make it very complex. Like we talked about OAuth 10 minutes ago, right? It is so hard to set up the entire delegated flows within OAuth. It's not for the weak-hearted. And that's one of the reasons why people don't embrace it as easily. So how do you make it simple? How do you gamify a little bit? How do you make it fun so that you can then say, hey, you know, using a very simple analogy, here's my risk thermometer, here's my mitigation thermometer, you know, let me show you where that is and give you some indication of how much risk you're taking or not taking can probably influence people from not rushing forward.
I agree. I mean, to changing the security mindset or the security culture that we have in organizations so that it's everybody's responsibility. And you touched on training, right? We need to totally revamp our training regimens. We all have the same multiple guess, how to identify a phishing email, bad grammar, you know, and other things. And in the age of AI, all that training is really no longer effective. The techniques and tools that you use as an individual to try to identify this risk are totally different now, right? AI makes a perfectly sounding email. There's no spelling mistakes. So trying to use that old multiple guess training, and people just click through it as fast as they can. We all do, right? Because we all have the same training. We got to get back to work. So making it gamified and making it so that the user can identify the risk, not necessarily the telltale signs of an attack, but what's the risk to me? What's the risk to the organization? How do I mitigate that risk? That's the sort of training that we need to integrate into our people. And then again, every time I talk about training, don't rely on it. It's not the first line of defense. It's one more tool in the toolbox. A lot of companies will say, oh, I trained all my people, we're secure. that's not how it works. Okay. So just, yeah.
Yeah. As somebody, you know, who was not a sort of cybersecurity professional, right, and who so spent, you know, years and years and years of my life taking those trainings as the employee, it's true. I didn't pay any attention to them, right? But, and now that I've come into this realm where I kind of do this podcast with folks like you guys, and I learn the concepts behind this stuff, it is so fascinating. And so I do think that, like, if you actually teach people the concepts and not just, you know, the scolding, hey, make sure you change your password, I do think you start to get somewhere. You know what I mean? It's like you said, Sridhar, give people an actual understanding of the level of risk that they are taking, and then they'll be like, hey, you know what? I understand this in a real context. I got to do something about it, you know?
Teach them how to fish, not...
Exactly, exactly. Teach them how to fish. Don't give them the fish. Let's move on then to our next topic today. We are going to continue a little bit on this theme of blurring the lines between people and non-human entities, if you will, with the malware that acts like a human. Specifically, I'm talking about a newly discovered banking Trojan nicknamed Herodotus, which evades behavioral detection systems by timing text inputs to look more like a human being typing, right? Now, this comes from Threat Fabric. They're the ones who found it. And, you know, in a lot of ways, Herodotus is very much like your standard banking Trojan. It gets in, it steals credentials, remote access, yada, yada, yada. But the one little wrinkle here that I thought that caught my eye was that, you know, in order to make it seem, in order to evade some of these behavioral detection systems, instead of just kind of inputting text all at once, Herodotus would take the text the hackers wanted to input, split it into characters, and enter characters one by one on a timing delay to make it seem like keyboard, you know, fingers on a keyboard. And, you know, I'm a non-technical person largely, but I thought this was interesting. But I want to ask more technical people, and I'll start with you, Chris. Is this impressive? Is this as clever as I think? Or is this not really that big a deal? What do you see here?
Both. I'm surprised that it took this long. Why is this the first one that we're seeing to do this? This seems like a really simple way to evade detection. You put in a random time in between keystrokes. Like, why isn't it? I mean, it's 2026. This should have been done 10 years ago, right? So in that case, yeah, this is kind of cool and interesting because somebody's finally figured it out. But on the other hand, why is the detection software looking at speed of key inputs as a metric to determine human versus not human? Like, I hope there are some other metrics in there that it's also looking at, because key input, like, that's a known heuristic that you can identify individuals by is how they type. Like, that's a known thing. So yes, this is both amazingly amazing and both, yeah, whatever, next, yeah.
I'm actually surprised as well, right? As we always think that our adversaries are way ahead of the defenders because, you know, they work together, they're more opportunistic, they're more entrepreneurial, et cetera, right? This one actually surprises me because we actually have a product, right, in identity space, which looks at a combination of your subject, which is the person, your action, which is the resource, your network activity, your environment, your behavior, which is not just your keystrokes and mouse movement, but also the fact that I'm doing a $30 transaction versus $3,000 transaction, puts them all through the ringer, and then tells you whether you want to do MFA or not an MFA. It calculates the risk, right? So that is, we've had it for 6-7 years right now in production, and IBM uses it, right? So I'm surprised that right now we are looking at something similar, which is probably one dimension. So maybe they will get exponentially faster. I see that eventually the attackers are going to start thinking the same way that we've been thinking, which is space bar or keystroke measurement is one dimension. They will probably look at other dimensions, right? So that they are able to then go and provide multiple parameters to be able to circumvent the fact that this is a bot versus a human, right?
Yeah, I'm glad that you kind of brought that up because that was what I was wondering, right? Is this kind of the beginning maybe of a little bit of your classic kind of arms race, right? Like you said, Sridhar, we have these kinds of behavioral detection systems that are pretty complex. These are a lot of different factors. Maybe the hackers just stumbled onto one of them, but maybe they'll start to use more of them. And then are we entering a world where these things are going to keep escalating? I don't know. What do you think? Is that where we're headed? Will we see more of this humanized malware?
I think there's two dimensions over here. One is definitely more humanized malware, and not just a humanized malware, but there's a sister side of it, which is automated red agents. So going back to the agent discussion that we had a few minutes ago, right? But I think that's one dimension. The other dimension is also, end of the day, the attackers are running a business. It's a return of investment. Why are they doing that? Now, they're not dumb, right? As smart as we think we are, we are not. At least I'm not, right? I think they're doing it because not everybody using the multidimensional risk analysis. It's very similar to MFA. How many people actually use MFA? Not a new technology. But I'm surprised that not many people use MFA. I see your head nodding, right? So it's the same thing, right? Not many vendors or not many organizations are using multidimensional way of evaluating if it's human or not human. Most people are still stuck on capture or maybe some traditional ways of doing that. And maybe that's what they're going after, right? So there's two dimensions that I look at. One dimension is where the maturity of the market is. And again, this is a precursor to something which is, going to explode as well. So,
yeah, I've been yelling at people to turn on MFA ever since I started covering cybersecurity and learned how bad passwords are at keeping you safe. I try to yell at everybody in my life, turn on MFA. And they don't always listen to you. Chris, any thoughts on your end here on what we could expect from this humanized malware trend?
Well, I mean, it's the old cat and mouse game, right? We put in a defense. The bad guys or criminals figure a way around the defense. And then we put in another defense. And then the bad guys, criminals figure out another way around the defense. So it just kind of goes back and forth. Do they have an advantage? Are they further ahead than us? A little bit, maybe. But then we catch up and pass them and it kind of goes back and forth. So this is, like I said, this is both novel and not novel. I'm surprised it took this long. And I'm kind of interesting to see what they come up with next to try to bypass some other humanistic heuristics that we have.
Let's move on then to our next story and talk about a very interesting smishing attack, one that's happening on a level that I personally haven't seen before. And this is a smishing attack that manipulates stock prices. This is a campaign that Fortra uncovered of a pretty large smishing network that is sending out these messages to basically try to steal people's brokerage accounts. And then once they get into the compromised account, they manipulate stock prices to make some money. Now, I'm going to quote Alexis Ober at Fortra to explain it, because again, this is a kind of thing I have not seen before, so I'm going to use her words, right? In these scenarios, the threat actor will liquidate any existing investments made by the victim and reallocate the funds to low liquidity stocks, often penny stocks or IPOs. Then they will artificially inflate the stock price by purchasing large amounts. And once at a profitable level, they will sell off the holdings to gain a financial profit before withdrawing any earnings using mobile wallets. Again, I personally have just never seen social engineering on this kind of scale before. You know, I've seen people get their individual bank accounts hit, but like to manipulate the markets, that's a little bit scary to me. I don't know. What about you folks? Any thoughts there? Sridhar, what are your feelings on this thing?
I want to step back, right? No, granted, it sounds really, really, cool, right? I have not seen this either, right? But I've seen similar things. But if I step back, the fundamental thing over here is stealing passwords. And that is the easiest thing that one can do today. And it's pains to say that, right? But that is a reality, right? Why go and jump the walls when we can go and cut the wire, a fence with a wire cutter and get into the property, right? So I think to me, we are seeing a beginning of how you can take advantage of compromised passwords, whether through phishing or whether to buying, hundreds of them or 100,000 of them at the dark web, that's easy to do these days. Once you do that, rather than trying to go do a ransomware attack, which takes a long time, the return on investment may not be as much. I look at this as an opportunity to say, hey, why don't I go and, take care of tens of thousands of brokerage accounts that gives you a few million dollars very quickly that I can manipulate the market. So the return on investment is way higher than having to live in a network for a year before I see the ransomware, right? So I'm thinking like an attacker, right, for a change. But I have to think there so that I can then start defending.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it's almost like basically every story we've covered so far is sort of the same theme that like everything old is new again, right? It's like you said, this is just, I had not thought about that. This is another kind of password attack, right? It's put to really neat ends, but at the end of the day, what are you doing? You're stealing a password. You're getting in there, you're stealing a password, and you're using a person's account, right? Chris, your thoughts there.
We've seen similar attacks with crypto, right? People trying to get the passwords, get in the crypto account, and liquidate the account and move the funds somewhere else. And we have seen some of this with brokerage accounts too, but it's usually liquidation and get out. Right? The manipulate the markets with the penny stocks. That's a new angle. That's an extra step. But at the it's still a password attack. It's still a Trojan that we're going after bank. We're going for the money, right? Whether it's crypto, bank account, brokerage account, they're going for the money. The added step that's going on here is that instead of just liquidation and get out, they're trying to make even more money before they can liquidate. Yeah, this is just, again, another step, another evolution that we're seeing in the criminal mind as they take it to the next level.
And all the more reason to turn on that MFA again, right? It's like you said, you want to keep people out. Just turn on the MFA, you know, maybe set up a pass key, put some more obstacles in their way, you know?
I do want to mention MFA is not a panacea, right? It's not a guarantee. There are ways that a really smart attacker can bypass MFA. But it's another step. It gets rid of the low-level attacks, the ankle biters, as we call them, and makes it more difficult. And by making it more difficult, remember I said the attacker is lazy, they're going to go to someone else because you've made it, oh, I'm not dealing with MFA. I'm going to go to this other account. That's what you want. You protect yourself. Let somebody else be the victim.
MFA is absolutely required. I think there's no question without, but again, too much of MFA also causes distractions, right? I think, and that's one of the reasons and one of the avenues that attackers use, right? MFA fatigue. Instead, I think we should think about in 2026 and 2025 and 2026 moving forward, right? We need to start thinking about the behavioral analytics, like we talked about in the previous section, right? The behavioral analytics, which is, of course, you got to look at the pattern, right? Where is this? Who's this person, whether it's a bot or a human, what device it's coming from, known or unknown, right? What is the network or the environment? Is it, have I seen this before or not seen this before? And the industry is actually doing a really good job with a open specification called shared signals over here, right? As a part of the OpenID. If you use something like that and collaborate on the shared signals, whether it's identity related, IOCs or IOBs or any other things, the more data that you have, the better you can do a risk evaluation to be able to stop this. So I think it's not just MFA is a means to an end, and it is a result for sure. But how you get to MFA has to be behavioral analytics.
That's a really good point on both ends. And yeah, I'm glad you said also, Chris, that, you know, the MFA is not a panacea, right? It's not going to fix everything. It's not going to stop everything. Because to be quite frank, I believe in this attack, one of the things that's interesting about it is that it does involve stealing one-time passwords, right? They have, and you know, again, it's safer to have that because it puts an extra obstacle, but it's not totally uncrackable. So you need those, like you said, those behavioral signals, Sridhar, that have become, and when you have a bunch of them, you can't fake those as easily, you know? Yeah. So let's move on then to our final story for the day, folks, talking about bug bounties getting bigger. This is a report from Bloomberg that reports that bug bounty programs are skyrocketing in both popularity and the amounts they're paying out, hitting some all-time highs. For example, HackerOne paid out $81 million over the past year, which is its single highest year on record, and a 13% increase over the previous year. So pretty significant jump. And what's particularly interesting to me here is that in an era of AI, when you have things like Google CodeMender coming out and all this stuff where people are like, hey, we're going to automate the ability to find your bugs, to see such a human-driven activity like this taking off even more, I just thought that was kind of interesting and not necessarily what I would expect. Chris, I want to start with you, as a hacker. What are your thoughts on this kind of thing right now?
I got a lot of thoughts on bug bounties. I'll try to keep it to this particular topic today. The big numbers that you're seeing for these specific bounties are for very specific, very difficult to exploit hard to find bugs. They're not your run-of-the-mill AI finds 100 bugs in an hour type bugs. These are the types of bugs that a state-sponsored actor would pay a lot of money for. And so the reason for these big bounties are to keep them out of the hands of the state-sponsored actor, right? So that they're not used against dissidents or on mass surveillance of citizens and that sort of thing. Your regular run-of-the-mill bugs that most people are able to find, that AI is able to find, those do not pay out anywhere near as much. But these big numbers also make great headlines, which helps the companies that run bug bounty programs, saying that, you know, all these, we're paying out all this money, come find bugs and become a millionaire. That's not really how it works. It takes a lot of hard work to make a decent money at bug bounting, and it's kind of a grind. But if you have the skill set, yeah, you can make some money there. But at the same time, you have companies who now have to, who are paying for this service as well. And then you have attackers who are using AI to find bugs and are flooding bug bounty programs. This is a whole nother topic when it comes to open source. And now I'm kind of going off into some of my other topics areas. So I'll leave it at that. Yeah, there's big money here that can be made, but it's difficult to make it.
Yeah, we'll have to have you come back and talk about this in more depth. But Sridhar,
I could do a whole show on bug bounties.
That's good to know. Sridhar, your thoughts on the kind of state of bug bounties today?
I can't seem to recall that the name of a movie, right, where this person is paid really, really high amount of money to hack out of a prison, right? And I kind of look at it like that, right? That, yes, you're legitimate, you know, burglar, but you could make more money doing ethically and legally than by being on the other side, right? So I kind of look at it in two dimensions, like you've seen my theme now. One dimension is, you know, for the attackers, like I said, right, I know, jokes aside, this is a legitimate and a legal way of getting really well paid and putting the best minds to that to say, you know, you can actually make a good living out of this, right? You use you know, expertise from Space Rogue and all the things that we do, right, as an example. The other dimension is from a company perspective, it is a small sum of money as insurance to pay for what may be a much larger, right, for paying like, you know, $1 million in bug bounty versus $10 million in ransomware, I'll take the first option any day, right? So as a result, you see both of those coming together into a perfect storm to increase the momentum, right? There's a desire to do more bug bounty legally, and there's a desire to pay more because that's an insurance, right? That's where you see this more and more on the increase. Now, having said that, you know, for both sides, right, bug bounty alone is not sufficient. I think, you know, Chris was also saying that, like, MFA is not the panacea. It's not the only thing necessary. Bug bounty is part of the resilience program, of the overall resilience program, basically, right?
You have to do all these things together. And bug bounty should actually be the last thing you do for all the stuff that you may have missed that you did check for. So, to second your opinion there, it's not the only thing you should be doing. It is one more tool in the toolbox.
Given their kind of ability to act as, like you said, this kind of last kind of line of like insurance of like, hey, we did everything we could to find this thing. If there's something still out there, we'll give you a reward for finding it. Do you think we're going to see the bug bounty programs kind of stick around? Or do you see a day that, I don't know, the AI gets good enough that this kind of thing goes away? Any thoughts there?
I think it's going to evolve, right? I mean, our attackers are going to evolve with more and more automated agents for doing attacks, right? Think of it as automated red teaming. And it'll learn on the fly, it'll learn all the TTPs, it'll learn all the vulnerabilities. And while you go get a cup of coffee, you'll probably have an exploit and probably the code generated to leverage that exploit, as an example, right? So I think what we will see is probably more and more purple teaming, right? Not just a mechanism to go and say, let me go and do this automated testing and then come back and fix it. But the speed in which it happens requires you to have some sort of a blue agent, which is able to go and, you know, fight AI versus AI. And then individuals then have to figure out how to govern those in a manner that that can keep up with the speed.
I think in the short term, it's hard to forecast out, you know, 15, 20 years. But in the short term, I think there's still going to be a need and a requirement for manual review of code, for the weird chaining of bugs together and finding that weird edge cases that AI is just not going to find for now. Right. I have no idea what's going to happen in 20 years. Maybe AI will be able to find it. Maybe we'll still need humans. But for now, and especially with red teaming and other security aspects, if you want those edge cases, if you want to find that weird chaining where you're putting five bugs together to gain access, you really need a human to do that. If you need a surface level stuff, you need to check a box. Get your AI agent in there and do your red team to check your box. But I hope at least we're still going to need humans for a little while. What I'm worried about, though, is that the AI is going to take all the low-level stuff, and we're going to run out of people expert enough to do the human stuff.
What I say, Chris, is AI is going to help us with speed and accuracy. No question on that, right? But I think the human ingenuity and creativity will always remain with us so that when you combine it, that's when good stuff happens.
I hate to leave you all on that question, on that slightly apocalyptic scenario, but that is all the time we have for today. So thank you, Sridhar and Chris, for being here. Thank you to our listeners and viewers. And folks, don't forget to check out the special episode we released last week, How to Break into an Office, which features our very own Stephanie Carruthers. Find it on Apple, Spotify, and audio platforms everywhere. As always, subscribe to Security Intelligence wherever podcasts are found, and stay safe out there.